The views expressed in this interview are those of the individuals and do not reflect the official policy or position of the U.S. government, the Department of Defense, the U.S. Navy, or the Naval Postgraduate School. Welcome to the Trident Room, brewer of stout conversation, unfiltered and on tap.
Part 3 of a 3-part series.
What was the emotional weight of writing about someone who fundamentally shaped your intellectual life?
I started with my own experiences with him and wrote that up. And a professor here is still a good friend, Hirsch Loomis, distinguished professor emeritus, read an early draft after just under 2 years. And he said, "Mandelberg, you're writing a biography, not an autobiography. Take out half on you."
Fair point.
And he was perfectly right. At the same time, fortune smiled, and I discovered over 12 other people who knew Richard Hemming back as far as 1958 and spent the time to allow me to interview them and or receive their remembrances, which are included in the book. And I cut myself to 9 pages with photographs, and they are 2 to 7 pages on theirs. The set of those 12 are remembrances of Richard Wesley Hemming. That makes the book, in my mind, a multiplayer. And it shows things that I never saw because they had their experiences. Many of these are distinguished professors at Dartmouth, at University of Maryland, at Princeton University, and some are faculty here or past faculty at the school, NPS. That set gave me a more holistic picture of the Richard Wesley Hemming I wanted to write, because it's not like my time with Maury. It wanted to be about Richard Hemming, not about my time with Hemming. With that, I embarked on a rewrite, which took another 2 years, and then COVID popped up in the middle, which slowed things down, and then also discovering how hard a biography is to write. And if I can, in 45 seconds, give you my reason why a biography is hard, and I will never again write another biography. In a biography, you must come up with some reveals. Otherwise, all you're doing is ChatGPT and rehashing what the internet and the world knows. I didn't wish to do that. Number two, I had a thematic that a person's legacy is more than what they attempt to accomplish. It should also include what's attempted and accomplished by the people they enabled and inspired. And so, therefore, I looked for people that Hemming enabled and inspired. How? More than the coldness of, here's his book, here's the review of the book, love the book. No, how did the book help somebody else? Those people's words gave me the support to work through it. Back to why a biography is so hard. You must have some reveals. There's at least a dozen reveals in the book. And none of them are trivial or salacious or things that people don't need to know. These are things that are worthy of future generations to know.
Were there stories or insights you hesitated to include, not because they weren't true, but because they were too intimate or revealing either to him or to you?
Yes, and I'll give you 2 examples. Richard Wesley Hemming and his wife chose not to have any children. Back in the late 40s, early 50s, and by the way, the evidence I have is one of the people who gave me remembrances of Hemming said to him, "Wanda and I have decided not to have any children, and I took care of that." I come up with the contemplation that either Richard or his wife had something surgically done to prevent pregnancy, a vasectomy or whatever. I chose not to put that in the book. That's personal. That's private. There was nothing about any rumor of either Richard Hemming or his wife having any flirtations with anybody else. They were popular figures. Richard Hemming did not drink alcohol. I tried to find out why, and I believe I did. His wife and Hirsch Loomis's wife liked occasional cocktails, but Hirsch Loomis and Dick Hemming did not drink. Richard Hemming would like to take people and talk about what they were doing, and Hemming's, with his ego, would often talk about himself. To some people, that could be construed as not nice or not good. I chose not to emphasize that in the book because my thematic was people, places, and events inspired and enabled Hamming, and he in turn inspired and enabled others. We all have issues in our life we don't want showcased on a blimp board. None of them were worthy of, why did you hide that? There were no issues that would have questioned it, but there were things I felt that was not appropriate for me to disclose. If his niece wishes to say something, that's her prerogative. I chose to be careful.
That's fair enough, and very fair to the story, I believe. In my own experience, I have written a course for my master's and various things for BS, as you do. Writing, I feel, forces a kind of distillation. Did the process change how you think about Hamming or about yourself?
Oh, good question. Since I started writing a full 8 years ago, Microsoft Word and my computer probably has 4 terabytes of versions of the Hamming book. Each day I would open the book, change the title to today's date, and incrementally during the day, increment the version number. So today version, if I were still writing, would be 17 June 2025, Richard Wesley Hamming, version 1. And a couple hours later, it would be version 2. I was semi-paranoid about losing where I was at, and the train of thought that caused me. And yes, I put track change on.
The nightmare that follows any writer.
Exactly. So as a consequence, many, many versions, many, many styles. At one point, it reached 125,000 words. And I said, very few people want to read War and Peace. So I started to do, there's a Ernest Hemingway joke, a phrase I have on a cocktail glass. It says, write drunk, edit sober.
I don't think I've ever heard that one. I like that.
It is on glasses for sale at the Library of Congress. I have a set. And so when I was writing, I would occasionally have a glass of wine or something because it was good. When I went to editing, I went sober. And then I had to hire an editor because I'm not an editor. And you edit your own work and you start spinning.
My brain will see words that are there and not see words. And yeah, you need somebody else.
So writing your dissertation, you usually don't have an editor. But when writing a book.
Maybe a friend.
Yeah. Tell me where I'm going wrong. Am I going way too far?
Right.
Yeah, my brain is going far. But I wanted this book to be successful. I didn't want to have put the 10,000 hours I estimate I put into this book away from my family and hobbies and other things. Because it was a little Don Quixote-esque, because how many people are going to buy a book of someone who was born in 1915 and died in 1998? A mathematician? Boring. A physicist? Wow. Neil deGrasse Tyson? I'm there. Carl Sagan? I'm there. A politician? Winston Churchill? Think of the common books. A mathematician? But he was more than a mathematician. He was a man and he was a mentor. And what influenced him is of value to know. What techniques did he learn and propose? What questions did he leave for us? The timeless questions, which is the last appendix. And when I said it was hard to write a biography, you have to reveal, you have to do references. The references have to be current. My editor, Carla Orvis Hunt, shout out to Carla, insisted that my references be correct as of the month of publication. So where I used a web page, if that web page was no longer up, I had to find another reference. Where something I was doing was at all controversial or new, I had 2 references. Because Hamming taught me a measurement is a measurement. Is it repeatable? I wanted repeating on anything I did that was a reveal. And the hardest thing was I had many people whose quotes I used. Well, it turns out you shouldn't have long quotes because readers don't want to read 14 sentences from Albert Einstein. They want you to do something which I had never learned in my entire adult life, paraphrase. Because all of my writings in the past had been my own words. You don't paraphrase yourself. You also don't reference yourself that often unless there's a previous document. So it took me a year to paraphrase 40 quotes. Because I insisted the following, because Hamming taught me that when you do something, make sure you do it right. Whenever you window some data, whenever you paraphrase a Nobel laureate, are you paraphrasing it right? You can't ask ChatGPT, it's not that smart. So I spent a week and read everything I could about what was Albert Einstein thinking and doing when he wrote these 14 sentences before I could paraphrase it to three. Now, maybe there was a shortcut way of doing it, but I didn't see a book of paraphrases out there. So I chose to paraphrase it. It took me a full year, and then a full year to reference properly, and hence it took me 8 years.
That's an impressive amount of due diligence that is honestly refreshing to hear about, because I don't hear about that much due diligence currently.
The rush to press.
Yes.
Get an ebook out, make money, look at the web, pops up on you. That was not my purpose.
It's almost like I felt that I didn't have permission to do that much or take the time to do that much due diligence, and hearing about it is refreshing. And
well, I had time. I'm retired.
Yeah, it lets me feel, at least, hopefully you listeners as well, kind of that you have the permission to do that amount of due diligence. What is the one idea or feeling that you hope a reader carries away after closing the final page of your book?
Almost everyone I know got to their point in life with the serious help of others, whether they be religious, spiritual, academic, or friend. We've all had mentors. I've been blessed with four. Richard Hamming was number three. Without a mentor, without a friend to say, you're going off in left field here, we'd be lost. Hamming prevented me from being lost and not completing my degree. He impressed me on the value of being a mentor and a professor, and insisted, in fact, that I teach his faculty and do research and publish. Because if all you do is get your degree, write a couple of journal articles, and disappear, then Hamming wasted his time with me. He wanted me to be a very good, maybe not world class. Very few people can be world class. I'm not going to win a Turing Award. I'm not going to win a Nobel. It's highly unlikely that this book will win a Pulitzer. But if anyone who's listening has the phone number of anyone on the Pulitzer Committee, I would welcome they forward it to me, Marty Manum.
We'll see if we can get connected.
What Hamming left me with just like having a best friend, the way you feel after you spend some time with the best friend, writing the Hamming book reawakened and focused in me the mentorship of Richard Wesley Hamming, and that his style and his gift to all of us who watch his videos, read his books, understand where he's coming from, those things will perpetuate space and time. They're timeless. His lessons are worthy of consideration. Don't do what Hamming did. You can't. My niece, Rebecca, shout out to Rebecca, says, don't try to be somebody else. They're already taken.
I like that.
Sorry if I embarrassed her, Rebecca. The power of mentorship, friendship, role models, persistence, determination, work harder, work longer. Don't take the easy way out. Go home, play video games. You won't get the future you want. Work on hard problems. The book ends with a Galileo and Newton quote. If I have accomplished anything, it's because I've stood on the shoulders of giants. I stood on Richard Wesley Hamming's shoulders and saw father and had a better life because of Richard Wesley Hamming.
I love that. Just a few more questions while I have you in the studio. Bringing it back to MPS, bringing back that legacy and everything that you've mentioned so far. If you could redesign one aspect of the MPS curriculum, not just the content, but the philosophy, what would you change or emphasize?
Well, that's a little difficult for me to give a definitive answer since I am not on faculty or staff. I've been a guest lecturer for the last 3 years in Don Brutzman's course. I like the push towards using Teams, especially during COVID, for online virtual distance courses to get people involved and interacting. The course that Professor Don Brutzman, shout out to Don Brutzman, who's retiring this month after 51 years with the U.S. Navy.
Wow, congratulations.
Submarine officer, Naval Academy graduate, professor here, almost 100 doctoral students, many master's students, very distinguished professor, good friend, big help on this book. He's a mentor to people. He was a help to me. His taking Hamming's course, Learning to Learn the Art and Science of Engineering, remastering the VHS tapes from 1994, enhancing the audio, putting it online for students. It's MV4000 was the course. I was a guest member on some of it. Don is retiring. I don't know what the school is doing. Shout out to the school administrators and dean of research. This course needs to continue, and so with other faculty members. Their magnum opus course should not go into the shelves of the library just because they're no longer teaching them. Video the courses, put them on Teams, make them interactive, use distance learning, handle the fleet, I'll use the Navy as the example, who can dial in and be part of it, because that's where the power of the future is, not sitting in a classroom the way we all did so many years ago.
Okay, thank you very much. How should MPS prepare students to lead in an age where AI, geopolitical complexity, and cross-domain operations are converging faster than institutions can adapt?
Well, you're putting on my strategist hat in here, and I am still a strategist for a number of organizations, all pro bono, so I won't affiliate with any of them because I have some people who seem to value my input. What they do with it, I may or may not know. It may disappear into a community who I no longer have trust. But they asked. Mm-hmm. Would you go over again that list of adjectives you used?
Yes. The question is, how should MPS prepare students to lead in an age where AI, geopolitical complexity, and cross-domain operations are converging faster than institutions can adapt?
Okay, suggestion for MPS. It's difficult for a master's student and hard for a doctoral student to pick a topic. The only other thing that's harder is to pick an advisor. The topic to meet those things, you may not get out of reading the journals. If it's strategic and geopolitical, if someone is in a master's program or a naval war college, before the student picks the topics, I think they should take a field trip to the fleet and to Washington and to think tanks and to another university and find out what's happening in the world that's hot. Years ago, when someone would get a doctorate, if you, for example, saw the movie Oppenheimer, brilliantly played, Little Hollywood, you saw that after Oppenheimer got his degree, he went to Germany and spent a little time with his counterparts from other universities to cross-fertilize and talk. I don't know that that is currently done at the faculty level. A student who wants to work on important problems and is willing to and able to devote the energy and the time needs to make sure he's working on an important problem, not just one of the 8 problems that the thesis advisor says, looking for thesis students to work on these problems. That's too much cookie cutter. Having done a master's at the University of Connecticut in adaptive filtering and doing 2 masters at the Naval War College, I had been working with the fleet for a while, and I had real-world problems of my own. When I came to Monterey, one of the problems was nonlinear dynamic model, whether it be the Mark 48 torpedo or multipath acoustics or real-world signal problem. I knew we were limited by the techniques. The Navy and the government are limited by techniques. Our warfare is becoming asymmetric. Look what the Ukrainians did with drones in, snuck into Russia and pop open, and all of a sudden strategic bombers get attacked by drones and destroyed. Amazing, amazing bit of stuff. I'm not going to go to the Mideast. It's still too current. It's too dynamic. I believe there is value that some percentage of the students should take a field trip before they pick their thesis and find a topic that they have a burning desire. Because to work on a master's or work on a doctorate that you're not burning on is just turning the crank. It's a course that has a paper at the end. If what you want to do is help the government, help the country, help the world, help industry, is to work in an area that you're passionate about.
Thank you. And last question. What advice would you give to a current NPS student who wants to make an impact not just during their next billet, but across their entire career?
In order to have an exceptional career, you need mentors. You need a best friend to keep you from going the wrong way. And you need, there's a saying we got at the War College back in the 70s. If you're the smartest person in the room, you're in the wrong room. My advice to people that I mentor, if at all possible, and I know in the military it's hard when a detailer assigns you your next assignment or there's a chain of progression that is typical for a surface warfare officer or an EOD or whatever. Those, particularly at the doctoral level, need to find cohorts and faculty who inspire them, not just turn the crank. Unfortunately, I made that wrong mistake because I had no experience. But fortunately, Professor Kirk and Professor Hammond came to my rescue. And NPS is capable with its funding, with its exceptional faculty. And I'm not saying this for any reason other than I believe it to be true. NPS is in a very good situation with its relationships to the flag officers, the undersecretaries and the secretaries, your guest speakers that you have out here, the superintendent's guest lecture. Use those, shout out to Admiral Rondo. Use your relationship with those people to find the hard problems that will light up the student in their young 30s can work a 16-hour day. Because that's where the results happen. Hamming complained to his boss, Baudet, that John Tukey was doing amazing things. And he was younger than Hamming. And Baudet said, well, if you worked a couple extra hours a day like Tukey did, maybe you'd get those. And Hamming said, wow, he's right. So Hamming worked 10, 12-hour days, not an 8-hour day and go home. NPS is not an 8-hour job. It's an opportunity to be passionate about the large problem you're working on, I think. This is Marty Mandelberg speaking. And have an exceptional time with extraordinary leaders here and at other universities. And do your master's thesis or maybe harder at the master's level, at the doctoral level, do something that the world will stand up and notice.
All right. Well, thank you so much for spending your time with me today. It has been a substantial amount of time that you've sacrificed and given to me and my team for this podcast, and we sincerely appreciate it. Please have all the success in all of your future adventures.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for joining us in the Trident Room. For more information about today's guests and topics, please visit the show notes online at nps.edu/Trident Room Podcast. The Trident Room Podcast has been brought to you by the Naval Postgraduate School Alumni Association and Foundation. For questions, comments, and suggestions, please email us at tridentroompodcasthost@nps.edu.